This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pynchon. I will be reading synopses of 10 articles published on January 2, 2015. The topics of the articles featured in this podcast are vascular disorders, surgical technique, anatomy, traumatic brain injury, hydrocephalus, and neurosurgical history. Diffusion-weighted imaging detected ischemic lesions associated with flow-diverting stents in intracranial aneurysms. Safety, potential mechanisms, clinical outcome, and concerns. A clinical article by Christina Yosef and colleagues. Flow-diverting stents were initially considered safe concerning covered side branches during endovascular procedures for the treatment of intracranial aneurysms. As newer evidence suggests, their use is not always free of ischemic concerns regarding covered arterial ostia. This is a prospective single-center study on a series of patients treated for intracranial aneurysms with flow-diverting stents. Effectiveness of anti-aggregation treatment was assessed for all patients. Diffusion-weighted imaging-detected lesions were correlated to the hosting artery and the side branch territories, and were statistically analyzed in relation to their time of occurrence and a clinical presentation. Over the course of 18 consecutive months, 38 consecutive patients with 49 intracranial aneurysms were treated using flow-diverting stents. Overall, 82% of the diffusion-weighted spots found remained clinically silent during the follow-up period. 5 ischemic clinical complications occurred in the post-procedural period, but no statistically significant correlation could be established between diffusion-weighted imaging-detected spots or aneurysm location and clinical complications at 3 months. Compared with stent-assisted coiling, the use of flow-diverting stents showed a statistically significant correlation with silent diffusion-weighted imaging findings post-intervention. Lesions seen on diffusion-weighted imaging that result from the procedure are far more common than anticipated, but the technique remains safe and effective, providing an interesting alternative for difficult aneurysms, regardless of location. Detector CT angiography within 24 hours after carotid endarterectomy and correlation with postoperative stroke. A clinical article by Christopher Galati and co-authors. Carotid endarterectomy has a small but not insignificant risk of postoperative stroke, which usually presents within the first 24 hours after surgery. New stroke after carotid endarterectomy requires urgent vascular imaging to determine management. However, there are few studies describing normal versus pathological findings on carotid imaging in the immediate postoperative period. This paper presents the largest series available to date of early CT angiography within 24 hours of carotid endarterectomy, and describes typical and atypical imaging findings seen on CT angiography after such surgery. Certain CT angiography findings are commonly present after endarterectomy, such as common carotid artery step-offs. Other CT angiography findings are of little clinical consequence, such as isolated external carotid artery flaps. However, specific CT angiography findings, such as internal or common carotid artery flaps and intraluminal thrombi, are associated with postoperative stroke and transient ischemic attacks. Knowledge of these imaging findings and their expected frequency and association with postoperative stroke can help surgeons and radiologists when interpreting early postoperative CT angiography after carotid endarterectomy. Prognostic value of premorbid hypertension and neurological status in aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. Pooled analyses of individual patient data in the SAHIT repository. A clinical article by Blessing Jaja and co-workers. What determines how well a patient recovers after aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage? The authors of this study have compiled the Subarachnoid Hemorrhage International Trial Lists repository data from approximately 15,000 individual patients involved in subarachnoid hemorrhage clinical trials. They used these data to assess prognostic factors for outcome. This study used complicated statistical analysis in collaboration with Steierberg and colleagues, who did the statistical modeling for the IMPACT Head Injury Project. In the initial analysis, the authors found an important prognostic factor was age. Now they examine the role of admission, neurological condition, and history of hypertension. The study found that premorbid hypertension was independently associated with poor outcome, which may be because these patients had more medical comorbidities and neurological complications. The other key finding was that neurological condition was a powerful prognostic factor. Worsening neurological status was strongly and independently associated with poor outcome. In conclusion, this study found a strong prognostic effect of neurological status after aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, as measured on the World Federation of Neurological Society scale, and the independent prognostic effect of premorbid hypertension. Classification of middle fossa floor dehiscence syndromes, a clinical article by Kunal Gupta and colleagues. Middle fossa floor dehiscence presents in different ways, and these presentations are in fact a continuum of severity, even though they tend to be described as separate entities. The authors describe a novel classification system for middle fossa floor dehiscence syndromes that reflects the clinical continuum. Class A is bony deficiency without brain or meningeal herniation. Class B is meningeal or brain herniation through the defect. Class C is cerebrospinal fluid leakage through the dehiscence. And Class D is meningitis due to cerebrospinal fluid leakage. Through a retrospective review of a single institution series, the authors describe the different clinical presentations in each of the classes, as well as the associated clinical features such as patient age and sex, duration of symptoms, body mass index, and so forth. The outcomes of the different surgical treatments for the various subclasses, as well as the morbidities associated with the surgical treatments, are also described. This novel classification system is simple and clinically relevant, and has the potential to guide the study, diagnosis, and subsequent management of patients presenting with middle fossa floor dehiscence syndromes. Microsurgical anatomy of the central lobe, a laboratory investigation by Thomas Frigeri and co-authors. The central lobe, composed of precentral and postcentral gyri and the paracentral lobule, is one of the most eloquent areas of the brain and is considered by many to be a single lobe. This article reviews the relationships of aspects of the central lobe useful in preoperative planning and as reliable surgical landmarks. The coronal suture, a palpable landmark seen on magnetic resonance imaging, is closer to the central sulcus and lobe at its lower rather than its upper end. But they are closest at the point where the superior temporal line crosses the suture. The authors review relationships of the central lobe to adjacent sulci and gyri, feeding arteries, and draining veins that are helpful in directing an operation after the brain is exposed. When operating in the central lobe, it is important to remain constantly aware of the position and trajectory of the feeding branches of the middle and anterior cerebral veins and the draining veins that may be hidden in sulci because of the severe deficits that may follow their occlusion. Despite some variability, there are common patterns in gyral and sulcal configurations, craniometric relationships, arterial supply, and venous drainage that can create a roadmap for approaching this eloquent area. A 3D endoscopic transtubular transcallosal approach to the third ventricle. A technical note by Alireza Shokazemi, Alexander Evans, and colleagues. Surgical approaches to lesions of the third ventricle have always been a challenge for neurosurgeons. In certain cases, the transcallosal approach provides the most suitable option for accessing these lesions. Although retraction of the fornices and the wall of the third ventricle have been associated with neuropsychological and hypothalamic deficits. A team of neurosurgeons at Weill Cornell Medical College have developed a novel 3D endoscopic transcallosal approach through a minimally invasive tubular retractor system for the management of third ventricular lesions. Transforaminal, interforniceal, and transchoroidal modifications were all performed and evaluated. Bayoneted instruments were used through the retractor without difficulty, and the ViewSight brain access system of tubular retractors applied rigid, constant, and equally distributed pressure on the corpus callosum. Application of the tubular retractor allows for enhanced visualization of the third ventricle and more stable retraction of corpus callosum and fornices. This technique also provides an added degree of safety by limiting the free range of instrument movement. The combination of 3D endoscopic visualization and a clear plastic retractor facilitates safe and direct monitoring of the surgical corridor. This study demonstrates that a transtubular approach to the third ventricle is feasible and facilitates blunt dissection of the corpus callosum that may minimize retraction injury. Aspirin is associated with an increased risk of subdural hematoma in normal pressure hydrocephalus patients following shunt implantation. A clinical article by Peter Birkeland and co-workers. Normal pressure hydrocephalus is one of the few treatable dementias. Treatment is by shunt implantation. When subdural hematoma occurs after shunt implantation, it causes patients harm and poses a challenge to the neurosurgeon. Some patients receive antiplatelet medication as a secondary prophylaxis therapy. In that case, aspirin and other antiplatelet agents are withheld 7 days prior to the surgery and resumed 1 to 2 days postoperatively at the author's institution. The authors investigated if shunt-treated normal pressure hydrocephalus patients on a regimen of aspirin therapy were at increased risk of developing subdural hematoma later. They retrospectively reviewed records from 80 consecutive patients implanted with a cerebrospinal fluid shunt and found 11 cases of symptomatic subdural hematoma. They found a significant increased risk among users of aspirin. In fact, all their cases of subdural hematoma were taking aspirin or clopidogrel. Of note, they did not find any difference in type and setting of shunts between groups. The authors recommend that the increased risk should be discussed with the patient prior to shunt implantation. The author's study has limitations. It is a single-center experience, and it is not possible to separate the effect of antiplatelets with the underlying comorbidity leading to antiplatelet therapy. The role of microscope-integrated near-infrared indocyanine green video angiography in the surgical treatment of intracranial dural arteriovenous fistulas. A clinical article by Harjot Thind and colleagues. The successful surgical treatment of an intracranial dural arteriovenous fistula requires complete obliteration of blood flow through the fistulous point. Digital subtraction angiography can be used to confirm fistula obliteration. However, this technique can be cumbersome intraoperatively and difficult to correlate anatomically with the surgical field. The authors retrospectively examined intracranial dural arteriovenous fistula cases in which microscope-integrated intraoperative indocyanine green video angiography was used to identify and/or confirm obliteration of the fistula. Over a 10-year period, in which a total of 47 dural arteriovenous fistula cases were treated surgically, video angiography was used in 28 cases. Video angiography successfully confirmed the identity of the fistula point intraoperatively in 96% of the cases. Video angiography also revealed complete obliteration of fistulas as well as intraoperative or postoperative formal angiography in 91% of the cases. The false negative rate of video angiography was 8.7%, which is similar to the false negative rate of intraoperative angiography at 10.5%, which is the gold standard of postoperative catheter angiography. In conclusion, indocyanine green video angiography provides real-time information about the intraoperative anatomy and surgical obliteration of dural arteriovenous fistulas. This technique, when used appropriately, is a useful adjunct during dural arteriovenous fistula surgery. Highly qualified loser, Harvey Cushing and the Nobel Prize. A historical vignette by Nils Hansen and Thomas Schlick. The brilliant neurosurgeon Harvey Cushing was nominated at least 38 times for the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine, which makes him one of the most often nominated surgeons for the Nobel Prize during the first half of the 20th century. In several nominations, Cushing was portrayed as the world's greatest cerebral surgeon, a man of great culture, and a brilliant writer. Other nominators argued that Cushing had contributed considerably to the field of brain surgery, especially concerning difficult brain operations on intracranial tumors. The authors of this article have visited the Nobel Prize archive in Sweden to find out why Cushing did not receive the prestigious award. They have also looked at the Nobel Committee files concerning the neurosurgeons Victor Horsley, Walter Dandy, and Antonio Egas Moniz. Although all four of them received multiple nominations, only Moniz was eventually awarded the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine, received in 1949 for the development of lobotomy. Why is that? In this colourful historical vignette, the authors take a look behind the curtain of the Nobel Committee and reconstruct the Nobel Committee evaluations of these neurosurgeons. Cerebral aneurysms and accelerated atherosclerosis in Russell-Silver syndrome, a new subtype? A case report by Heinke Pilhorn and co-authors. The authors present a case report detailing unusual features of Russell-Silver syndrome. They describe a 32-year-old woman, the daughter of consanguineous parents, who is known to have Russell-Silver syndrome. She exhibits some of the known phenotypical features of the syndrome, but in addition, she has features of premature aging of the peripheral, specifically the intracranial, vasculature. When the patient was aged 25, she had suffered a subarachnoid hemorrhage secondary to a left-sided middle cerebral artery aneurysm. At 32, she presented with a further subarachnoid hemorrhage that resulted from a ruptured right-sided proximal middle cerebral artery aneurysm. Digital subtraction angiography also showed the presence of a right-sided distal middle cerebral artery aneurysm, an aneurysm of the basilar artery tip, and an aneurysm of the right superior cerebellar artery. Extracranially, the patient's vessels were heavily calcified, with 50% narrowing of both common carotid arteries and reduced caliber of the common femoral, external iliac, and internal iliac arteries. These pathological features of the peripheral vasculature have never been described in patients with Russell-Silver syndrome, and thus may denote a new subtype of the syndrome. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is contained in the AANS iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for JNSPG and AANS podcasts and videos. Content is updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.